Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're back, right? We are actually back because on the screen it says we'll be right back, but I believe we're back. So not that I like to point out other people's little foibles. I'm not that kind of person. I'm totally that kind of person. 888-318-7884 is the number. If you're watching us, we're back. It says we'll be right back, but we're back.
Don't they already know if we're back?
I think they probably do, yes. Yes, that's called being a nudge. I'm just being a nudge. It's open. No, it's not. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You can call and ask him anything. Anyone can call anywhere in the world who can dial into the United States, 888-318-7884, or from within the United States. You're welcome to call with whatever your question is. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of the book we just gave away, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Also, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Also, like a million other things. And he's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah, how about that?
I used a million hyperbolically.
Oh, I knew.
Oh, you did. Okay. All right. I didn't want to put any pressure on you.
Not that that's far off, but.
I know. I have no idea. I was looking through Wikipedia pages the other day, and I was like, I'm going to see Jimmy Akin's Wikipedia page. And it's got a partial list of publications. I was like, that's the partial list. That was pretty impressive. All right. Let's go to Cameron. Oh, right here in San Diego. Cameron, right here in San Diego, watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, Cameron. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. How are you doing?
Doing okay.
I'm glad to hear it. Okay, I have a bit of a long-winded question, but I'm going to try and be as concise as possible.
Thank you.
I recently watched a debate you did with Trent Horn versus Sam Nissan, something like that, on the issue of justification.
And his partner, if Trent and I were both in it.
Yes, wait. Yes. That's what I meant. I apologize. Yeah,
okay.
excellent debate. Slightly under 3 hours. I recommend everyone go watch it. In the debate, you talk about the doctrine of purgatory, the necessity of a cleansing post-death, pre-heaven. And the necessity of shedding what I believe you called ties to experiential sin. And my question for
you. Don't know that I use that language, but okay.
Sorry, not experiential. I can't remember what
disordered desires.
Term was, but
disordered desires is what shed in purgatory.
Yes. I apologize. No problem. But my question to you: the objection that your opponent brought up was that in shedding our earthly bodies, we also shed those attachments to sin. And thus, in heaven, when we are given new glorified bodies, we no longer have those attachments, thus getting rid of the necessity of purgatory. So my question to you, and the objection that you made to that statement was that he was basically calling our earthly bodies sinful by necessity. But my question to you is, if our spirits are washed clean when we are given the grace of Christ and salvation, and when we do shed our earthly bodies, what is the necessity of purification for our spirits prior to receiving our glorified body? Does that question make sense?
Well, let me have a stab at it, and we'll follow up and see if I've answered it for you. In regard to the first thing, my opponent in this debate, so like I handled half of the debate and Trent handled half of it. My opponent in this debate seemed rather confused regarding the answer to the question of do you need to be purified after death, because he at one point he did say something very much like what you just reported, but he also then seemed to say something about we're going to be purified by seeing Jesus. And so he seemed to be confusedly proposing two different explanations for why he thought we don't need purgatory. In regard to his first claim that we drop our disordered desires when we drop our bodies, that would root all of our disordered desires in our bodies. And there's a problem with that, in that damned people exist, and they drop their bodies too. So if damned people exist with their wills fixed on evil, that would seem to suggest that our disordered desires aren't simply rooted in our bodies. To borrow a parable from our Lord, you know, whatever enters a man's physical body is not what makes him unclean, because it's going to pass through. And actually what Jesus says is then go into the latrine, although they don't typically translate it that way in English. What Jesus indicates does emerge, does make a man unclean, is what comes out of his heart. And here he's not thinking about the, you know, 2-pound hunk of meat that's beaten in your chest. He's thinking of your spiritual heart. And so we have, even though we have metaphors about the flesh tempts us to do this or that, we can't confine our disordered desires to simply being a bodily phenomenon, because damned people have them too. Their wills, in fact, are fixed on evil. So we've got pretty good evidence that that disordered desires are not exclusively a bodily phenomenon. The second thing that he gestured towards about we don't need purification because we're going to see Jesus also does not do away with the need for purification. It just means Jesus is the means of our purification. In fact, by articulating that as a possibility, he's essentially endorsing Pope Benedict's view of purgatory, because Pope Benedict understood the fire of purgatory to be the fiery, transforming love of Christ. So purgatory is an encounter with Christ that, in Pope Benedict's words, cannot be calculated in earthly time. So you can say, oh, from an earthly perspective, it's instantaneous. Well, fine. Pope Benedict doesn't have a problem with that. So you still have something doing the purification. It's just the fact that we're having an encounter with Jesus. So those were the two components of his answer. Unfortunately, we didn't really get a chance to explore that in the debate, but that's what I would say about those two components. Now, in terms of your question, if our souls are washed clean, why do we need purification when we drop our bodies? Well, our souls, the question is, what are our souls washed clean from? They're clearly washed clean of all sin. That's the teaching of the Catholic Church, that everything that is properly sin is removed from our souls when we're justified. But we still have to deal with concupiscence, or disordered desires, as evidenced by the fact that after we become Christians, we still have disordered desires. And unless you're prepared to root those exclusively in the body, which goes contrary to the view that that damned people exist, then you're going to need to say that they are an ongoing spiritual reality that will need to be dealt with before we have the full glory of heaven. Because in heaven, we're not going to be tempted by sin. We're not going to have disordered desires. And so something needs to happen to remove those desires. You could propose it's seeing Christ and having an encounter with him. You could propose it's something else, but something needs to deal with them.
Now, Jimmy said we'll go back to you, Cameron.
Excellent answer. However, I do have one objection to it.
Okay, what's the objection?
I agree with everything you've said. However, it does not follow that the fact that the souls of the damned have also shed their earthly bodies, because they also the objection that there exist the souls of the damned in hell who are still tempted by sin and have not shed those desires for sin, because their spirits would not have been washed clean. It's a combination of the two things. If you divide it into two parts, you have your body A, your spirit B, both have connections to the desire for sin. If by the grace of God here on our earthly life, the spirit is shed of that desire, well, it could still follow that the body can become the source of that. And once you shed that body, you're left with a pure spirit. I'm not sure I agree with that. For reference, I am Catholic. I believe all this stuff. I'm just anticipating this as an objection when I get to discussion with some of my Protestant kin. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does my objection make sense?
Well, so it seems to me that there, if I was going to argue against this position, I mean, that's, you've articulated one possible way of trying to evade it. The difficulty is going to be claiming that even in this, because essentially what you've said is we have disordered desires because of our body and we have disordered desires because of our soul in this life. And so if our souls are purified, the body is the only remaining source of disordered desires. Well, okay, number one, from a biblical perspective, that's going to be hard to sustain. But also from a reason perspective, that's going to be hard to sustain. People make choices where they're not under any compelling bodily interest that are sinful. I mean, I could understand if someone would say gluttony or lust, you know, has a root in bodily desires, but envy doesn't. You know, so there are a bunch of sins that don't look simply physical. They look like they are part of our souls. And furthermore, you're presupposing a particular type of cleansing of the soul that would remove its disordered desires. And that's not something we find taught in the New Testament. So I'm anticipating, you know, interacting with Protestants like you are, and they've got a sola scriptura perspective. And so if they proposed this to me, I'd say, so where's the scripture telling us this? Because this is not something that is typically part of Protestant doctrine. And if you believe in sola scriptura, you're going to need to be able to produce scriptures to back up this claim or set of claims. Furthermore, there are other Protestants, I would also point out to them, who agree with the Catholic point of view. C.S. Lewis, Jerry Walls, actually, there's quite a number of different Protestants who support some understanding of the concept of purgatory for reasons that I've outlined. And I would say, well, show me why these guys are wrong. So there are a number of possible ways. I mean, yes, you can deny purgatory if you bite the bullet hard enough. But you're going to have to pay heavier theological prices. The other way to do it would be to say that, well, the souls of the damned actually are perfect and pure and holy souls. They're just damned. But they don't have their wills fixed on evil. And Christian theology has just been wrong about that. But then that creates its own problems. Like, if the souls of the damned are perfect and pure and holy, why isn't God treating them like they're perfect and pure and holy? Why didn't he forgive them for what they did if their wills are now turned towards God? That doesn't seem just, to punish someone whose will is turned towards God for all eternity based on something they did in the past and no longer endures. So you can, if you're willing to deny enough, you can evade purgatory, but you're going to have to pay heavy theological prices for doing it.
Cameron, that certainly brings us to the break. As a matter of fact, we're a little past time to take the break, so I will say thank you for the call. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We'll be right back with more after this.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN is everywhere. EWTN radio programming is provided free of charge to over 500 domestic and international AM and FM radio stations. It's a great teaching tool for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. For a complete list of EWTN AM and FM stations across America, visit EWTNradio.net. At the bottom of the page, click Affiliates. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
We're Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest covering the world today on Catholic Answers Live, which is kind of fun. Diaz is in India watching on YouTube. Well, that's a rarity for us as well, Diaz, to get a call from India. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, sir, for attending my call.
We're so happy to have you. Go ahead with your question.
Namaste, Diaz.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Namaste, Diaz.
Oh, thank you so much. Namaste, sir. Namaste. Actually, I'm a Catholic person, so we don't say namaste in our community. We say Jai Yeshu in Hindi. It means that praise to be Jesus in English.
Oh, beautiful.
Jai Yeshu, Diaz.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much, sir, Jeremy. And thank you so much, sir. Actually, sir, I'm having a question. And this question has been raised by Muslim people to me because many times when I talk with other religion, other faith people, then they raise some question. And this is a question that is bothering me from a very long time. And
what's
literally
the question?
I'm having no answer for this. Yes, sir, I'm going to ask. Sir, if it is John's Gospel. Chapter number 7 from verse number 53 John's Gospel, chapter 8 till verse number, I think it is still 11, the adulterous woman account. So this particular verse, even the some of the footnote has been saying that this is a particular passage. It's not found in the original Johannian writing and the longer reading of Mark also. So my question is this, that always Muslim people, they say that Bible is corrupt, Bible is changed, and it has been manipulated. Later on, a lot of verses has been added to it, a lot of verses has been removed to it. And one thing they show for this, like our Father prayer from Matthew's Gospel. Because in Matthew's Gospel, if you go to old like traditional text, then like the King James reading or Douay Rheamsun, it is having the doxology. And I think you know what I'm talking about. But
yes.
If we are going to read our new Bibles in these days, then the doxology is not there. Even 1 John 5:7, that the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit, that these three are one. That is also in the King James, but not
Diaz,
in our,
you're putting a whole bunch
Bible.
Of so Diaz, hang on just a second. You're putting a whole bunch of different issues on the table, and there's no way I'm going to be able to address all of them individually. Can you sum this up into an overall question for me?
I just want to let you. Yes. I just want to present my case that this is the type of question I am having, and now you address.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so let's deal with the Christian half of this, and then let's deal with the Muslim half of this. So God promised that he would give his word to his people, and he did, and he divinely inspired some of them to write it down. But he didn't promise that in copying the scriptures later, nobody would ever make a mistake. And so scribes did make mistakes as they copied things down. There are a variety of causes for that, which have been studied by scholars, and not just Christian scholars, but other scholars too. And the good news is because the Bible, not the Quran, is the most successful book in world history, we have more manuscripts of the Bible than any other book in world history. And we're able, and that's a good thing, because we can use those different manuscripts to correct each other. So based on rules, this is a science called, it's sometimes called lower criticism. It's also sometimes called textual criticism. But scholars have worked out rules to try to figure out which reading was the original. Now, you cited the most, there are only two notable passages that are of any length in the New Testament that look like they may not have been original. You named the account of the woman caught in adultery in John and the longer ending of Mark. And those are the only two. You then proceeded to name a couple of shorter passages that just amount to a verse each. You named the doxology, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, that got attached to Matthew's prayer because of Matthew's version of the Lord's Prayer, because it had been, the doxology had been used in the liturgy and people thought oh, well, maybe why isn't that here? Because I hear it in the liturgy, and they added it in, not realizing it was a piece of the liturgy rather than part of the original text. And then you also mentioned the Ioannean comma about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit being one. But those are like the most famous examples, and that's kind of pretty much all there is. There are lots of little bitty things that don't affect the meaning of passages, like you just change the word order, and word order doesn't mean the same thing in Greek that it does in English. I don't know about Hindi, but Greek has very flexible word order because it uses inflections for nouns and adjectives that are case-based, and so you don't have to put the words in the same order to convey the same meaning the same way you do in English. So there's lots of little variations that don't affect the meaning at all. And so we're actually in a very good position to know what the original readings of the New Testament were. There's debate about a few passages, but it really doesn't affect any of Christian doctrine. Now, what about the Muslim side? Well, the Quran, like the Bible, was also invented before the printing press. And so consequently, the Quran also had to be hand-copied prior to the invention of the printing press. And that means scribes made mistakes in copying the Quran too. And we can show that by comparing different versions of the Quran to each other, particularly ancient manuscripts. And there's evidence that at a certain point, Muslims collected up a bunch of the early manuscripts that had diverged so much that they then burned them. They got rid of the evidence to preserve only one version of the Quran, which then itself went and was subject to scribal mistakes later on, because every book in the ancient world is subject to scribal mistakes. The good thing about Christianity is we didn't burn the evidence. We kept it, and so we're able to reconstruct the original reading of the New Testament far better than Muslims are able to reconstruct the original reading of the Quran. Frankly, they're in denial about this problem, but it remains the case.
Diaz, I'm going to leave it there. I'm, again, delighted that you took the time to call us from India. Thank you very much. I hope we'll get to speak again. But from India, we go to Central New Jersey. Donald, listening on domestic media. Glad you're here, Donald. Hang on a quick sec while I get the right button here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi there. It says Central Jersey. I assume that's the island of Jersey over in England.
Donald, are you in Jersey in England or in New Jersey in the United States?
New Jersey.
Oh, okay. We got it right. Okay.
Go ahead, Donald.
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to say that Pope Francis is one of the most loving, compassionate men I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was wondering, I have a few things about him that I consider he may be a heretic. Is it too controversial?
No.
Yeah, because he's not a heretic, but go ahead and I'll try to help you out.
Okay. It started off with the Pachamama, and then faith and morals. He blesses same-sex unions. That seems immoral to me. And he should have schismed against the German church, but instead he turned right around and almost is doing the same thing right now in a case of marriages or unions.
Hang on, Donald. There's not a lot of time, Jimmy. Do you want to have a full list, or you want to take those three, or how would you like?
Well, I think I probably better limit the number of things, because if otherwise I simply won't have time to respond. We're about to hit the break, Donald. So I can respond to the Pachamama challenge, the blessing same-sex unions, and what was the third?
Let's see, faith and morals, because this, that's same-sex unions. I'm talking about Brazil Synod too. That's the last one.
Oh, Germany's synodal way. That was the third. Okay, so I'll address those three things when we come back from the other side of the break, and I'll also give you a general principle that you can employ to deal with other situations that you may find troubling as well.
Donald, very grateful for the call. Just hang on. We're going to get to it. We're going to take a break that'll be very quick. All the lines are full. I'll keep giving out the phone number, but all the lines are full. And we are grateful for that. I don't mean to have a tone in my voice about it. We are very grateful for it. As we head into the break, I'll invite you again. Please check out CatholicAnswersConference.com for all the information about our big conference coming up September 26th through 29th right here in sunny San Diego. The theme of the Congress of the conference, excuse me, we can't hold a Congress. We're not that, we don't have that kind of authority. But the theme of the conference, learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. It's going to be a great time. Check it out at CatholicAnswersConference.com. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Donald in New Jersey had a bit of an extended list, but we got it down to three of questions about Pope Francis. As the Pope, is he a heretic? Jimmy, you've got the three items that we've got to.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah. So first, here's the general principle. We need to understand what heresy is. Heresy is the post-baptismal obstinate doubt or denial of a truth that must be revealed, that must be believed with divine and Catholic faith. Now, that's kind of hard to process, so I'll put it in other terms that are going to be a little simpler. What a heresy is after someone's baptized, they refuse to believe something that is a dogma. And so that's the essence of heresy. Someone who's baptized refuses to believe a dogma. And we talked about what a dogma is earlier in this episode. A dogma is an infallible teaching where the church has infallibly defined that something is part of divine revelation. Okay. So in other words, a heresy is for a baptized person to refuse to believe something that the church has infallibly defined to be part of divine revelation. So if you're going to accuse someone of heresy, much less accusing the Pope of it, you're going to need some pretty good evidence that he's done that. So, and another principle of law is you, in matters like this, you have to give a favorable reading whenever possible. And that's also dictated by the fact that the Pope is our spiritual father. And so we need to give a favorable reading to his actions whenever we can. So you named three things, Pachamama, blessing same-sex unions, and the synodal way in Germany. Okay, so the Pachamama thing right off the bat is problematic, because even though you had lots of people saying this is an idol, that's not at all clear. And because this is not a traditional figure that you find in South America, it's this statuette, or actually it's made out of wood, but it's a carven of a pregnant woman, and she represents Mother Earth. Okay, so you can have a personification of Mother Earth without it being an idol, and this is not an established image. They made this up for the Amazonian Synod. So given that, when you see the Pope, you know, having an Amazonian Synod and this statuette is involved, what our normal basic interpretation should be is, yeah, this is a statuette they came up with for the Synod. It personifies Mother Earth, and that's as far as it goes. That's the charitable reading here. It is a non-charitable reading to go beyond that and propose this is an idol and the Pope is worshiping it, because he wasn't doing that. He didn't worship this thing. It's just a symbol of Mother Earth. So so we don't have evidence here of him committing heresy. What about blessing same-sex unions? Well, I understand the confusion on this because of the way the press handled it. But Pope Francis has repeatedly confirmed, including in his recent interview with 60 Minutes, because the interviewer, O'Donnell was her name, I believe, said, "You've blessed, now allowed the blessing of same-sex unions." And he immediately leapt in with, "No, I have not. I've allowed the blessing of two individuals, but not their union." And he's right that, now you may think this is a good idea or a bad idea. Personally, I would have phrased the document differently or not done it at all because of the confusion it was going to generate. But blessing people who are sinners or who are struggling with sin and trying to live in God's grace, that's legitimate, because we're all sinners and some of us are trying to live in keeping with God's grace. So blessing two individuals is not a heresy, no matter what they're doing. And as a way of encouraging them to live by God's grace in conformity with his law. Now, I think the document, Fiducia Supplicans, was very badly phrased. And I think it blew up in their faces, as one could predict it would. So I think it was a bad idea. And I think the document itself, if you wanted to do something along these lines, you'd need to build in very firm statements of clarity about what this does not mean, and they didn't do that. So, you know, I think there's a lot of ground for criticism here, but denying something the church is infallibly defined to be divinely revealed, that's not what's happening in this situation. So it's not a heresy. You can argue it's a bad idea, but bad idea does not equal heresy. Then there's the German synodal way. And Donald suggested that he should be drawn harder lines with the synodal way. Well, the problem with doing that is that could actually bring on a schism. And so what the Pope has been doing has been trying to avoid a schism. He's been laying down various lines with the Germans, and they keep crossing them. Well, if they keep crossing them, even when he's being nice about it, you could imagine if he suddenly became Mr. Stern authoritarian, they would march right over those lines. Or at least one could argue that's what they would do. And so one can debate about, is his approach to the German synodal way the optimal approach? Does it need to be tweaked in some way? Does he need to be more confrontational? Well, maybe, but he's not denying something that has been infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. What he's trying to do is avoid a schism. And that's a matter, how you avoid a schism is a matter of prudential judgment. Sometimes you're hard, sometimes you're soft, sometimes you're a combination of both. And he's actually been pursuing a combination of both strategy. So I think one can question if that's the right strategy, but he's simply not doing anything heretical. He's not denying something that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. So he's not a heretic.
Donald, thank you. Thanks very much for the call, for the question. I hope that answer was helpful to you. As we've been saying, every line continues full, so on we go for more calls. Richard is in New York City. New York City, listening on the Alexa. Richard, go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call. I've struggled with the scripture for many years, Romans 10:9, which reads, if you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. I've always struggled with the part of you believe in your heart, especially understanding that faith is a gift, and I guess believing in your heart would be a gift too. It would be a grace. And I always wonder, do I believe in my heart, especially when my heart is not as tender as I would like for it to be because of hurts in the past and so forth.
Okay.
And I walk around wondering, do I believe in my heart? And it just eats away at me. Like, I don't know if I believe in my heart. I want to believe, but I don't know.
Okay. So I understand the situation because people can get into kind of a thought trap where they're questioning themselves over and over about, do I really believe, or things like that. And they feel like they have to have a certain level of confidence in order to really believe. And asking that question process as part of the thought trap undermines their confidence. And really, confidence is a feeling. It's not a belief. You can feel great confidence in the Christian faith, or you can feel little confidence in the Christian faith, because confidence is an emotion, and emotions are not beliefs. All you really need to do to establish whether you believe in your heart is say, do you accept that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Do you accept that he rose from the dead? Regardless of the level of confidence you feel about that, if you accept the New Testament message about Jesus and say, I may not understand it, I may not feel confident, but I accept it, then you believe in your heart. And that's all you need to do, is ask yourself that question. And then you should not get scrupulous about it and keep asking, but what level of confidence do I feel? That's a separate question. And you'll feel less confidence if you keep asking it than if you just say, well, I've accepted it, that's what I need to do, and I'm not going to worry about it beyond that. That's actually what will encourage you to have more confidence, is ceasing to question how much confidence do you have.
Does that help you, Richard?
A lot, yeah, that helps. I mean, I do believe that Jesus is Lord. I do believe he's the Son of God. Mm-hmm. I read my scriptures, but this always the scripture is just like, So I thought I called today. Thank you for answering that question.
No problem. Glad you called.
Beautiful, Richard. You sound relieved. Hey, if you'd like a book, I'd like to send you a book called Secrets from Heaven, Hidden Treasures of Faith and the Parables and Conversations of Jesus by our good friend, Father Sebastian Walsh. If you'd like a copy of that book, all you got to do is wait on the line and give an address to Edgar when he picks up the line. I'm going to go to a quick break. Then we will be back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
At EWTN Radio, you're family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205 795 5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Every single line full for two straight hours. Wow, wonder who's popular around here. It would seem to be Mr.
People
Akin.
People just want to call in and have you process their questions.
That's it. They're like, whoa, man, I can't wait to have Cy hand me off to Jimmy. All right, let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Amber is in Birmingham watching on YouTube. And I think you've been waiting a long time, Amber. And I apologize for that, but thank you for waiting. No, Amber? Did I push the wrong button? Maybe Amber didn't wait.
Line two.
All right. It's line two. All right. I'll tell you what, Amber, if you hear this in a minute, just hang on. I'm coming back to you. I'm not leaving you. I just can't hear you at the moment. Hunter's in Georgia watching on YouTube. How about you, Hunter? Are you there with us?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. You scared me. That pause scared me, Hunter. Yeah, I can hear you fine. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call, Jimmy. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes. What's your question, Hunter?
Okay. So a while back, I watched this documentary called Secrets of Christianity, and it's by a Israeli journalist called named Simcha Jacobovich. I may be butchering that.
Oh, sure.
And so there's Simcha.
I know who you mean.
Okay. So there's an episode they did about the sea voyage to the land of the Gadarenes, and they try to prove that the land of the Gadarenes is in Spain rather than in the Sea of Galilee, and then during the episode, there was a part where a biblical scholar by the name of James Tabor,
I know him too.
He says that that one of the things that's often forgotten about the job of the Messiah is that he's got to bring in all 12 tribes of Israel back into the land of Israel, and that basically Jesus didn't fulfill that because the Gadarenes were supposed to be the lost tribe of Gad, and he didn't bring them back during his first coming. So I guess my question is, how did Jesus fulfill the prophecy, the messianic prophecy about bringing in all 12 lost tribes of Israel back into the land of Israel?
Okay, so the first thing to know is James Tabor is a very eccentric individual. He has a lot of views on various matters that basically there's no other support for in the scholarly community. He's an eccentric. That doesn't mean he's always wrong, but it does mean whenever you hear him say something, you really want to look at it to say, how good is the evidence here? When we're talking about the prophecy that the tribes would be reunited, there's actually a debate in the Jewish community about that prophecy. It seems pretty evenly split there, but you find in Talmudic times the rabbis debating about that, and does this prophecy still apply or has it been canceled? Because when the 10 lost tribes left, they lost their Jewish identities. I mean, when they were taken into captivity, they eventually lost their Jewish faith, they lost their Jewish identities, they got integrated with other peoples. And so and they disobeyed God. And so for those tribes, are they going to be brought back? Well, there's a lot of Jewish scholars who would say no, they're not. They invalidated the promise by abandoning God. And so that's one possible solution here is, oh, and I should say James Tabor's idea about Gad being in Spain, and that's the Gadarenes. That's all just crazy. The Gadarenes, as the Gospels indicate, were on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, not over in Spain. But And we also know where the 12, where the 10 lost tribes went, and they didn't go to Spain. But one solution is the prophecy is it became invalid. And so Jesus didn't need to fulfill it because it became invalid. Another solution is, well, and this is actually one that there's support for in some of the church fathers, is Jesus did reunite the tribes after his first coming because they blended in with these other people in Mesopotamia. And he and Mesopotamia became Christian. So they were spiritually reunited with his other people. And thus, all the different tribes were reunited, because there are Jewish Christians and there are Israeli Christians. Even if they lost their identity, their descendants still became part of Christianity. And so he may have fulfilled the prophecy that way. And then a third possibility is he hadn't gotten around to it yet, but he'll do it at the second coming, just like there are other prophecies about bringing world peace and stuff that haven't yet been fulfilled, but will be fulfilled in a greater way at the second coming. And maybe this is just one of those prophecies, too.
Hunter, thanks. I hope that was helpful to you. As I've been saying, lots of folks on the line, so on we go. And we're going to go back and talk to Amber in Birmingham, Alabama, watching on YouTube. Amber, sorry we had a trouble connecting a moment ago, but I'm glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, y'all. That's totally my fault. I apologize. I have been so inspired by apologists that I would love to become one myself one day. And I was wondering if there's any requirements really for taking on that kind of role, like needing a master's in theology or something like that.
No, everyone can do apologetics on whatever scale is appropriate for them. You don't need any professional qualifications. There aren't master's programs in apologetics, not in the Catholic world anyway. I don't have academic qualifications beyond, I mean, I have a philosophy degree, and that helps with apologetics. So there are things you can study to help, and philosophy is one of those things. But fundamentally, if you put in the work to get the knowledge, that's all you need to do. Most of what I've learned about apologetics is stuff I self-studied, and I also learned on the job, because my philosophy degree prepared me for certain questions like, does God exist? But then when I and also as I became a Catholic, I had to convince myself of the truth of Catholic theology and see that it was, you know, better biblically than the Protestant theology I already had. And so that kind of gave me a background in Catholic apologetics. But then when I started working as an apologist, people ask all kinds of questions that are not properly apologetics, like this one, which is about how you become an apologist instead of being an apologetic question. Or people, we did a show a month or two ago where I noted for each question what category it technically went in. And they were questions about history and science and the Bible and liturgy and canon law and all these different topics, none of which were apologetics. But they were questions people had, and I wanted to help them out, and so I did. But a lot of that learning was self-study and stuff I learned on the job by doing it, which is fundamentally how you get the skills. You get apologetic skills by doing apologetics. You could do it in person, talking to people. You could do it on social media. You could do it on YouTube. But if you're interested in being an apologist, you know, there are some books you can read that would help. There are some, you know, academic programs you could take. I would recommend the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics for online apologetic instruction. But there are a variety of different things. But fundamentally, it comes down to doing the work and get an experience, both in terms of self-study and in terms of actually applying the skills and helping figure out how to help people with the issues they're dealing with.
Okay, Amber.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what, Amber, I don't know if you've got any of Jimmy's books, but I'd love to send you a Daily Defense. I think you would enjoy that.
I was going to suggest that one.
If you've already got a Daily Defense, just tell Edgar you'd like another one of Jimmy's books, and he'll help you pick out a different one. But a Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist, is yours if you'd like it. Just give Edgar an address to send it to. I'm going to go to Oklahoma now. Alicia is in Oklahoma. Alicia, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was calling because a couple friend of ours, they have asked us to be on their will to take mm-hmm. their two children in the event that, you know, hopefully never happens, that both of them pass away. We would mm-hmm. take them in and have them be our children. But they mm-hmm. have, they're not Catholic, and they have requested that we do not baptize them. Mm-hmm. I've talked to my husband about this, and I think we're both in agreement that at the age of reason and above, if they were to come into our home and they told us they wanted to be baptized, then we would have them baptized, because I'm not going to mm-hmm. deny that to them. Prior to the age of reason, though, I don't know if it's, like, my husband's on the side that we should respect their wishes. I'm more leaning towards I want to do what is best for the children in terms of their soul. Mm-hmm. In any of those events, like, you know, before the age of reason or after the age of reason, do we tell them that, you know, I'm sorry, we're going to baptize your kids, or can we honor their request?
Well, you can honor their request. Now, I agree, after the age of reason, it's the children's decision. And so they're no longer infants at that point, canonically speaking, and they have the right to make the decision themselves. So that's not the issue. The issue would be, before they hit the age of reason, would you deviate from the parents' wishes? And I would say that's a debatable question. I think people can have different opinions on that. And if you and your husband, I would also say that if you and your husband conclude that you can agree to this in the, God forbid, rare circumstance that this would actually happen, you know, because it's hard to find people to take your kids, you know, and they obviously think a lot of y'all if they're asking you to do this. And it's very unlikely that both of the parents would die. So this is probably a moot situation anyway. And the kids are going to be non-infants. I mean, the church customarily recognizes the age of reason as like 7 years old. So there's only a limited window of time. It'd be even more unlikely for both of the parents to die in that window. So this is probably a moot situation. And I probably wouldn't have an issue agreeing to it, you know, at least provisionally. Now, if, God forbid, this actually happened, then I'd probably reevaluate and say, should we still continue with this understanding? Or now that we actually are in charge of the children's good, you know, maybe we need to take another look at this, and you might come to a different conclusion. But I think, given the unlikelihood of this, you know, and the difficulty of finding someone to take your kids in the event of a tragedy like this, I would not insist that you make the decision now to definitely baptize them and tell them about it, because it is a situation where one could have different conclusions that one comes to, and trying to sort it all out at an advanced stage like this is something that I don't know that I would do. If you want, you could kind of I'm not going to say split the baby down the middle like Solomon did, but you could say, you know, we understand your wishes and we will do our best to honor them, and leave it at that.
What do you think?
That's not a promise. That's not a promise that you're going to honor them, but it's, we're going to do our best to honor them, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think that what they're wanting is a definitive, like an actual answer, either yes or no. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we're kind of having the hard time with it. So I don't want to tell, I think my husband would feel, and I feel a little odd too, telling them, no, we won't baptize your kids before the age of reason. And then, you mm-hmm. know, the unfortunate circumstance happens, and then go ahead and baptize them. Yeah. But I wasn't sure anyways, if they're not like babies, if they've never been raised up in a faith, like they might know faith mm-hmm. from us, but their parents aren't religious, like if it would be appropriate to baptize them anyways, because they wouldn't really know anything of Christianity.
In the rule is, in danger of death, children are to be baptized even against the will of the parents. But otherwise, there is a natural law right of the parents to make determinations. And so you want to try to honor their wishes apart from like danger of death situations.
Alicia, thank you so much for waiting and for bringing the question. I hope that was helpful to you. It sounded like it was, but you can always call back on another day if there's more follow-up that you'd like. Jimmy Akin has been our guest tomorrow morning. The second part of the Unicorns episodes airs. The saga of the Unicorns. Thanks, Jimmy. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That'll do it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.